Oh, never mind, you've got it.
Thank you. The recordings have been started.
Thank you, Nicola. Greg, would you like me to do a quick roll call?
Well, it sounds like some people are having trouble getting into the conference line.
Okay, I'll let the operator know.
I see James is waiting.
Hello?
Hi, it's Martin here.
James here, joining.
Hi, James.
Okay, good. Sounds like we've got the operator letting people in, so let's...
Gradually.
Let's go ahead and take our roll call then.
Good afternoon, everyone. On today's call, we have Greg Aron, George Kirikos, Basil Shah, Mike O'Connor, Barry Cobb, Rod Rasmussen, Mike Grodenbach, James Bladel, Martin Sutton, Fred Fellman, and from staff we've got Marika Konings, Margie Milam, Linda Saint-Géry, and Gisela Gruber-White, myself. Thank you.
Okay. And I see a couple of folks are in the conference call, but not in Adobe. If you can't get into Adobe, that would be great.
Philip Corwin has just joined as well.
And Barry, I know you can't join Adobe today because you're on the road. Okay, let's get started. Our agenda is as follows. We're going to talk about the who is query to the council. Then we'll get updates from our existing subgroups, cyber squatting group, the uniformity and contracts group, the malware and botnet topic, and then we'll continue working our way through our list of issues. So the first question is the who is query to the council. I put a draft out a week ago to the list. There was one comment, which was from Faisal. As background, the working group methods that are incorporated into our charter say that if we have a recommendation to the council, we're supposed to kick it up to them. And we have discussed this a little bit in the past, this particular issue. What I'd like to do today is fine-tune this letter, and then we should record everyone's point of view on it. So we'll actually attach names to it. I mean, basically, what came out of last week's discussion was that we did want to make a recommendation. And that's what I heard. And we are allowed to do. In fact, the working group methods actually say if we have a question, we're supposed to make a recommendation to the council. They'll consider it, and they may or may not agree on it. So we'll kick it upstairs and see what they say. Faisal, did you want to make some recommendations to the letter?
Well, I guess my whole point on the letter was that, I mean, I thought it was good. I think it was well-developed. I think it had some good history on it. I guess the only issue I had was that I thought it should be a little less leading. I mean, like I said in my email, that we should basically ask the GNSO for recommendation how we move forward, but not basically say that we don't want to discuss it or that the group is reluctant to really get into the who is issues in our group. So, I mean, there were a few places in there that needed to be tweaked, but other than that, I think the goal that we were trying to achieve is, I'm agreeable with.
Marika, I see your hand.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to point out that Liz Gaster also sent a message to the list pointing out what the current status is of the WHOIS activities, and in that she noted that there's currently no policy work going on. The only work that's being done is on costing out and assessing the feasibility of the studies that were identified, and once that has been done, the council will need to take a decision as to which studies, if any, they will go further with. But there's, just to clarify, there's currently no policy work going on WHOIS.
Correct. And that, our letter is consistent with that status, is it not?
I think you do mention somewhere that you don't want to conflict with any of the policy work going on, so that could be the only way of, I'm trying to find what that was, but this is basically just to clarify to the group that there is no other policy work going on apart from the studies that that we're looking at. So,
yeah, it's in the third paragraph. It says, WHOIS is a topic within the GSL policy-making scope and an area around which there are abuse and compliance issues. So it does sort of mention that, Marika, as you mentioned.
Okay. Mike Rodenbaugh?
Hey, Greg. I'm really with you on this letter all the way down to the however after your parts A and B. I'm not sure that I've heard people say that WHOIS should be a central topic of discussion or that we do research on the topic. I'm not sure this is really necessary. If we do send something like this to the council, we can expect to really not hear anything back from the council for at least a month. Given that our next meeting is this week, I believe, and it obviously will not be on the agenda for that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
The next meeting after that won't be for 3 weeks. So I'm just not sure what the point of this is. I mean, if there are folks on the call that do believe that WHOIS should be a central topic of discussion or that we do research, I just don't feel like I've heard those people. I thought that we had reached rough consensus around the notion that WHOIS is certainly an element of many forms of registration abuse, that we would point that out as we're going through our checklist, and certainly we could make recommendations that, you know, WHOIS be more accurate or whatever in connection with our final report. Am I off base? Does anybody think that we agreed to something different or that other people felt substantially different than what I just said?
I think that was what our discussion was. Fred had posted to the list saying that he thought WHOIS should be a central topic of discussion and should involve research by this group. So, if somebody feels that way, we have to, you know, acknowledge it.
Is that right, Fred? I just don't recall Fred really saying that, but maybe I just missed it.
I didn't say it exactly that way. I said that I thought that registration abuse, WHOIS abuse was central to the other registration abuses that we're examining, and that we can't ignore WHOIS's contribution to the abuse that we're seeing.
Which I feel like that's consistent with.
I agree with you.
Okay, so I mean, I think we all kind of agree down to that. However, is that right, Fred?
That is right.
Okay, Fred, I was trying to accurately state what you had said. You had said, I would recommend that we include it as a type of registration abuse and gather more facts around it. So I took that to mean it needs to be a major topic. But if I was wrong, no problem. Okay, so if we have some agreement, then the question is, how do we word this? And we need to do some wordsmithing. Now, to be clear, what we would be doing in this letter is we would be saying to the council, this is what we think should be done. Okay? And that's points A and B. Maybe we need to wordsmith those a little bit. If the feeling is unanimous, then we can take out that sentence about that follows that. Who is should be a central topic of discussion, etc.
I would say we just leave it pretty much as is until the end of your point B, and then we say something like, is this consistent with the council's charter to the working group? You know, basically a yes or no question.
Yeah.
And, and leave it at that.
Okay, so what's our question to the council then?
Is the working group's rough understanding consistent with the GNSO's charter of the working group? You know, something like that.
Okay.
If we even feel this is still necessary to go to council, I mean.
Well, it would be an area that we would be excluding from our charter. It's not explicit right now.
So, Greg, this is five of us. We're not, if there's no policy currently underway, why, I guess I'm confused as to why we can't develop certain policies around who is in this group.
Well, let's put it this way. There's been a lot of work around it so far over the last several years, and there is process on who is underway. Our understanding, as far as I understand it, is that the council decided that this is a whole area that needed discussion and study, and so they basically commissioned a set of questions, and then they commissioned a set of studies, and then policy making would take place at a point in the future.
Greg, can I make a clarification?
Go ahead.
I just want to clarify that as this is not a PDP working group, this group will not be able to make any policy recommendations at this stage. It can, however, make recommendations for policy development processes related to specific issues. So just to clarify that, I mean, if this group would decide that they feel there should be a policy development process on who is or specific questions related to who is, that is a recommendation this group could make for the council then to consider whether or not to initiate a PDP. But this group itself does not have the status to make actual policy changes or policy recommendations. So
sure.
I just wanted to clarify that.
However, if we recommend one, we do have to go through the process of doing our research and telling them why we want to do it. In other words,
well, but it would still need to be initiated by the council and follow the current policy development process. So start with the issues report, create the working group, have an initial report, have a public comment period, and go to a final report. It would still need to go through that process, even if this group would come up with very specific recommendations. In order for it to be policy, it would need to follow a policy development process. I mean, I think Mike, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but that's my understanding of the council process.
I think that's basically correct. I would just say that as we've happened with the domain tasting situation, the PDP that follows this group could be, frankly, just much shorter and quicker than other PDPs because a lot of the background work will already have been done.
So basically, we can make recommendations, right, Marika?
Well, it depends. You can make recommendations, but we need to go through that process. So
right, okay.
I think it's just to take into account for this group as well how much time they want to spend on fleshing out certain recommendations, take into account that it will need to go through a separate process anyway. So it might be as well that this group says, well, it will take a lot of time, for example, to make specific recommendations on who is. So, you know, it might be easier to say, okay, these are the specific questions we think are suitable for policy development. So this is what we recommend, and then take into account that those will be further worked out.
And that's, I think, the crux of the issue. Thinking about what topics need to be addressed and so forth. And the question to the council is, haven't they already done that or not? Because they came up with a whole list of questions that they wanted to study, and has that work already been done or not? Are we duplicating work?
Well, I think what I'm hearing from Fred and Fivel and myself is is that we're basically agreeing with you on your statement of what is rough consensus in this group, Greg. And so if that's correct, then why do we need to keep talking about this right now? Why don't we move on?
Are you saying we shouldn't kick the question to council?
I don't frankly see the point of doing that right now. Again, we won't have an answer for a month anyway. We're going to need to continue having calls. Meanwhile, if we agree that who is not a quote, registration abuse in and of itself, but is a factor in a bunch of other abuses, which we will discuss as we discuss those other abuses, let's just take that as our operating instruction and start talking about those abuses.
This is Mikey.
Go ahead, Mike.
What if we, instead of asking permission, begged forgiveness? What if we wrote this note that said, here's the course that we're following. Dear counsel, if you disagree with this course, let us know. But otherwise, here's where we're headed.
Yeah, that's fine. That was my suggestion a few minutes ago also, you know, unless we just decide not to send anything to the council at this point. But I'm really fine either way. If enough people think that we should get a check on this from the council, no problem. We can do it.
Okay.
Just don't expect an answer anytime real soon.
Okay. And Jeremy had his hand raised.
Just on the who is side, I'm kind of with Mike on this, where I don't really know if this is going to be an area where, even if we came up with some very novel or very interesting who is recommendations, that either they would be well received, that some process would work on them. And I think that it's pretty well known that there's abuse in who is there. There's no verification process. There's no information that's checked. It's basically garbage in and garbage out. And I don't know, other than saying, hey, this is a problem, and simply stating it like that, if there's anything beyond that that we're actually going to be able to accomplish.
Okay. All right. So we have a proposal. One thing we can do is go ahead and ask the council formally to exclude who is from the charter. And we also have Mike O'Connor's idea, which is to send them basically an FYI note saying that's the way we're proceeding. What we could do is, does anyone have a preference?
Well, hey, Greg, this is Faisal. When you say you're going to exclude it from the charter, we aren't necessarily excluding it from the charter. We're discussing who is in the context of other abuses, though, right?
Right.
I wouldn't say that it's completely excluded. I think there are discussions and maybe ideas that come up while we're discussing other registration abuse. I may go even farther a little bit and say I think there is registration abuse on its own in who is, but I would go along with Fred and Mike and say that, to the extent we're discussing it in the context of other abuse, that's fine, but I don't want to exclude it completely from the charter of this.
Oh, yes, and I don't think anybody actually has said that it's not a registration abuse, right? But the idea was leave it off our list of abuses for major examination. Okay, so we can make a recommendation to the council and formally request that we exclude as per A and B, or we just send them an FYI and say, this is what we're doing. If you have any questions about it, let us know. So what I'd like to do, Mike Rodenbody's, I see your hand up. Do you want to?
Oh, no, sorry, that's old. I'll take it down.
Okay. All right. Well, tell you what. We have two courses of action that have been proposed, and what I'd like to do is have a show of hands. The first one is to send this letter. We'll tweak it, but basically send this letter and say we would like a formal consideration on this question by the council. The other alternative is to send them an FYI saying we're not going to be discussing it as a major topic. Okay, so what I'm going to do is let me write down these two so you can see it online. Just give me a second.
So, Greg, this is James. I would recommend that we use the agree, disagree to indicate which of those two courses of action you prefer as opposed to raising of hands. That can be ambiguous.
Right. Okay. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put some language into the window. A second. There's the statement, and please use your agree or disagree feature in Adobe Connect. Barry, what's on screen is as follows. Recommend to Council, because of the past and present GNSO efforts, update the charter, leave who is off of our list of registration abuses for major examination, research, and recommendation making, and include examples and background in its report when who is issues are a factor in other abuse issues. In other words, not try to make policy recommendations as or recommend PDPs or et cetera, but definitely do include in the report when who is issues are a factor in other abuse issues.
I guess I can't really say agree or disagree, but I'm for the just the FYI option and consider it who is elements in our further discussions.
Okay. Basically, if you agree with what's on the screen, that means send to the council, make a recommendation. And if you disagree, then you're asking for the FYI option.
Disagree, please.
And George, you had a question?
So if we want to continue to make recommendation making, we should have disagree then. Like, we're not going to research a study. Let's say we wanted verified who is as one possible solution or recommendation. Then we'd have to vote disagree on this. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the group has already – here's the thing, George. The group has basically said it's not going to look at who is as a major topic.
Right, but as a possible minor topic amongst all the topics. Like, for example, I thought cyber squatting was out of scope because of the registration and use aspect, that it's more of a use than a registration. If we're going to go that route that it is in scope, then I don't see why who is shouldn't also be in scope. Just using the same logic that was used for the cyber squatting scope issue.
I guess part of the question is, cyber squatting hasn't received the same amount of attention over the years, and there are no current study questions or PDPs or anything else going on with it. However, who is different. Okay. So, don't see votes from Mikey.
Yeah, I can't get the gizmo to work. So I'm in the disagree column. But.
Okay.
Yeah, this is so I can't get my stuff to work, so I'm in disagree as well.
Okay, so that was Mike and Phil?
Mikey.
Mikey? You were disagreeing? Okay, so that leaves with the FYI to council. Okay. So,
Greg, will you send around one more draft of that, just for final comments of the list?
We'll have to rewrite a bit.
I mean, basically, it's just stopping after your point B on rough consensus and saying this is You know, is this consistent? We're not even asking a question. We're just saying we believe this is consistent with our charter. Let us know if you feel otherwise.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'll take as an action item to update that. I'll send it out to the list, and I'll give everybody a couple of days to look at it and suggest any additional updates. Okay. Good. Just a second. I need to write some stuff down, and then we'll go ahead. And Fred, you had a question?
I'm good. I was just going to point out that Faisal could not vote because he can't get onto the meeting.
Yeah.
Okay. Faisal, you, how are you voting?
I voted on disagree.
Okay. I'm just writing down who is here. Martin, Andy, Greg, Fred, Faisal, Gretchen, James, Jeremy, Mike, Rodenbaugh, Mikey O'Connor, Phil, and Rod. Did I leave anyone off the list?
George, I voted disagree too.
George, okay. Thank you.
And Barry.
And I'm sorry?
And Barry, Tom.
Barry and Martin. Okay, great. Unanimous then as far as I can tell. Is that correct? Okay, let's move on then. Thank you. Okay. Next question on the agenda is an update from the Cyber Squadron subgroup. Which is Fred, James, Michael Young, Paul, and Phil. So I turn the one over to you guys. Can you give us an update?
Yes, I can take that. That's good law. So I just said something around, it'll be 10 minutes before the call. I'm sorry I sent it late. I'm just in the midst of a little vacation right now. I did send around a proposed draft, which you all should have now, which basically takes the current definition from the UDRP and are considered by U.S. courts anyway under the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act. And I've pretty much delineated what comes from where in the email. And propose that given that this is pretty widely accepted throughout the community as a definition, that we adopt it and move forward.
Okay. So what we could do is we could put that material up on the wiki where everyone can take a look at it. Are you comfortable putting it up there?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, I should also say, you know, as a matter of process, I sent it to the subgroup. I mean, you named everyone on there. I think there's six or seven people, 2 weeks ago, and hadn't had any response. So, you know, I don't normally assume that silence is assent, so anybody in the subgroup can certainly speak up now. It's in the working group, and we can hash this out.
Okay. We don't hear any.
Actually, Greg, this is James. I have my hand up, but...
Sorry. Sorry, I was in another view. Sorry. Go ahead.
That's okay. And I just wanted to mention that in this particular case, silence is assent. Like, I didn't have any issues necessarily with the definition or the language that you'd submitted. And I think that was, for the most part, that was similar to the language of the June 22nd document that's that Fred had submitted to the wiki. Is that correct, Mike? Or were there any substantial or material differences between those two?
I would say that what I added was a couple of the topics that come from the ACPA statute that aren't otherwise specific. And I point those out at the bottom.
Okay. The key thing that I think, and the reason my hat was thrown into this ring when we were in Sydney, was that the original wording seemed to be a bit prescient in that it was understanding intention, and it also could have been construed to identify or include any sort of domain investment activities as abuse. And I think that, just wanted to make sure that we had a little more substance around those and we didn't catch a lot of babies in with the bathwater that we're trying to get rid of. So I think that we're okay with that, but I see that there's some other folks with their hands raised that are also in this group, so I'll leave it at that.
Fred?
Yes. I actually agree with I looked at Mike's definition. I thought it was really good capture of cyber squatting and a good blend of ACPA and UDRP and represented what the community defines as that abuse, so I'm comfortable with it.
Okay. Bill?
Yeah, I had two questions on this for Mike and for general discussion. And Mike, I apologize for not getting back sooner on this. It's been incredibly busy since you first sent this out. But on the up to the two editions, obviously it's taken straight from UDRP, so that's fine. On the first one, I guess, small Roman numeral 5, my question, is this language exactly from the ACPA, or is this kind of an interpretation of the ACPA?
It is pretty, I tried to be as exactly faithful as possible while, changing it to "you have provided," for example. I don't think that language is in there. But yeah, I tried to keep it as close as possible, yet still read consistently with the rest.
All right, so on small Roman numeral 5, my question would be, obviously, where it says you've provided material and misleading false contact information upon application or you've failed to maintain accurate information. Fine up to there. See, my question is on the part that begins with "or your prior conduct indicates a pattern of such conduct." Would that, I'm not sure how to read that. It seems to say that it might apply to a case where you haven't, where you have applied correct information and you haven't intentionally let it go bad, but somehow it's linked to prior conduct on other names. I'm not sure how to read that "or" clause.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I'm not either. At first read, it seems almost superfluous, but then I think you really did nail it. It seems to address the situation where the instant registration at issue has correct information, but there's still a prior pattern of providing false information.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. I mean, what if someone had been a bad actor and now they're complying, they're providing correct contact information, they're not letting it go bad? Why would any prior conduct, and there's no limitation of how far that goes back, be held against them if they're now conforming their information to requirements? It's all correct.
I do see your point. I did not, just come create this. It certainly is out of statute. I'm frankly not aware of any case where that's been addressed by federal courts. It certainly doesn't mean it hasn't been addressed. But I would be comfortable removing that phrase, but I don't know if others would.
Yeah, I just think it confuses things. Clearly, I have no problem if someone in their registration has either provided material or misleading false contact info, or they originally it was correct, but now they failed to they've changed their contact info and they haven't updated it intentionally. No problem with that. It's this OR clause that causes me concern because it seems to sweep in prior conduct with no limitation how far you're looking back and applying that to a name where there may be no problem with the contact information.
And, you know, frankly, I think there's enough other things that are probably going to be a factor in any bad registration that going back and proving a prior pattern of false who is just not something that most brand owners would need to do. So.
Okay. And then my question on small Roman numeral 6 is on the second part of it where it gets into dilution of famous marks. In the U.S., the anti-dilution statute is a pretty recent enactment. It's many years after the ACPA was enacted. I'm not sure it was directly incorporated into the ACPA, but I'm not sure the context of the concept of dilution is. And I'm not another trademark expert to know, but I'm questioning whether on a global basis the concept of dilution is. Uniformly accepted to a sufficient point where it should be part of our working definition. So it's a factual question about where dilution stands in kind of global trademark practice.
I think you do know that it's not universally accepted. It has come out of U.S. law. It is fairly new doctrine, you know, arising in the last 10 years or so. So I think I tend to, again, agree with the gist of your point here that may not need to be part of our definition.
Yeah, I think we ought to stick to definitions which are pretty well accepted on a global basis, or at least, you know, in the major trademark registration countries.
Okay, Phil, do you have any other...
Those are my comments, just trying to get clarification on those points.
Okay.
So just to make sure we get it clear, though, you would support removing the final clause of Roman numeral 5 and the, let's say, the second half of the of number 6?
Yeah, well, the OR clause of number 5... I think confuses the whole matter. It looks at past conduct without limitation and could be read to apply it to a case where there's no material and misleading false contact information. And number 6, I don't think we should be floating the dilution concept if it's so new and fairly unique to the U.S. and a few other jurisdictions that it's not generally recognized in trademark practice.
Okay.
And I don't think we're giving much up by that. I think we're just staying within the consensus view of trademark policy.
Okay. I see George's hand raised.
I have similar concerns to Phil. Three total concerns. One broad concern is the fact that you want to have a globally acceptable definition, not one that just picks from one country, in this case the United States, for the last two factors, the V and VI. Specifically that's going to overlap with the who is discussion that we just had. But on VI, this came up in the IRT sessions. There are countries that don't have famous marks at all, that don't recognize famous marks. And so the United States does, but if we're going to talk about this as a global definition, you know, you could have a registrant in China, you can have the registry in Ireland, and you could have a complainant in the United States. Which mark are they going to find to be famous? A U.S. mark, a Chinese mark, or a U.S. mark? And so then you say, well, it has to be a globally famous mark. And then you get into a big argument again. There is no globally famous mark list, in other words.
I think I'm hearing that your comments, George, are essentially consistent with Phil's. And would you be comfortable if we deleted those two parts of those two sections?
Just reading the first part of VI, multiple domain names which you know are identical or confusingly similar to marks of others that are distinctive at the time of registration. What does it mean to be distinctive at the time of registration?
So that's specifically intended to ensure that, so with trademarks, there's a range of strength of marks, if you will, from generic, which can't function as a mark, to arbitrary, like Exxon, or, you know, made-up words that can function as very strong trademarks. Those are arbitrary, and then the next category down below arbitrary is distinctive, meaning that it has acquired distinctiveness in the minds of consumers as relating to a particular source of goods or services, as opposed to descriptive, which is something like almost generic, basically.
Right. My concern about distinctive is that it's not as strong as the other, where it's a coined term like, Exxon. So somebody that owns multiple dictionary word definitions, are they caught, multiple dictionary domains? Because almost every dictionary word, almost every acronym, every single letter, almost every two-letter domain has some trademark. Is that going to be caught up by this definition because some of those marks are distinctive?
This is Greg. I have a question on number four. I'm working my way through those ors in the latter half of that. So four basically says you're attempting to attract for gain people to your website or another online location by creating a likelihood of confusion. As to the source, sponsorship, affiliation, or endorsement of your website, or location, what does or location mean?
Oh, I'm reading that now. I think that that's a typo. I think that first or location should be stricken. I could go back and confirm that real quick in the text of the EDRP, but I think I just simply made a typo error there.
Okay, so basically the idea is you're creating likelihood of confusion as to the source, sponsorship, affiliation, or endorsement of your website, or of a product or service on your website. Okay, just trying to parse it out there. Okay.
Also, actually, this is quoted here. I did not make a typo. It is quoted directly from the UDRP as stated on the ICANN webpage. So I think what it's intending to mean, endorsement of your website or location, I guess I really don't know. I've never thought about that before. It seems to be endorsement of your website or domain name, maybe.
It could be one of the other services. Like there's 65,536 ports. You could have, a chat room. You could have something other than a website.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Does it mean physical location?
No.
Something out of, you're selling something out of your store.
Again, I've never seen any discussion of what that means.
Okay, well, we'll chalk that one up as a question.
Going back to VI, isn't every trademark by definition have to be distinctive?
Yes.
Within its service area, right?
That's correct. In other words, it cannot be merely descriptive. It has to be distinctive, yes.
Because your registration or acquisition of multiple domain names, which you know are identical or confusingly similar to marks, because of others that are distinctive, that means registered marks. So basically,
we're getting into a big difference between U.S. law and some other countries' laws, where there isn't an examination for distinctiveness. People can simply register by the act of registering.
Right.
That allows Italy some other places. So.
My concern is that every dictionary word has a registered mark of some sort. So BI collapses that if you own two domain names that are dictionary words, you're caught, somehow a cyber squatter by this definition.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Just because they're registered in Benelux doesn't mean that they're distinctive.
No. Is every U.S. mark distinctive?
Well, and also, any U.S. mark can always be challenged, even if it is awarded.
Oh, simple question. Is every U.S. registered trademark, does it have to be distinctive?
In theory, yes.
Okay.
In practice,
so every U.S. mark is distinctive, period. Every dictionary word has a U.S. mark. You own two domain names that are dictionary words. You're a cyber squatter under this definition, correct?
No.
Where did the logic fall apart then?
The logic falls apart because if you're using generic domain names in their generic sense, then you would be fine. But if you're using generic names, your supposedly generic domain names to refer to distinctive marks and their goods and services, then you would be a cyber squatter.
Well, first, this definition says your registration of mark doesn't say anything about the use. And, still it doesn't make any protection for generic marks in this definition. There's no... notwithstanding or blah, blah, blah. I'd rather we stick to just the general definition of the UDRP and not try to, expand the scope of it by...
Okay, so I think we understand your point is that you'd like to see six stricken entirely.
Yeah, that or strengthened to not create this, interpretation, which is perfectly logical and valid, that if you register, two dictionary words, those are, identical to marks that are deemed to be distinctive because they're registered trademarks in the U.S.
Okay. Well, I guess what I would ask is if you would come back with an alternative statement of it.
Well, I would rather strike it and then let somebody else come up with the definition.
I'm sorry?
I'd rather strike it. Like, it's not the onus.
Okay. Well, that's not what I thought you would rather do. So, okay. I mean, let's see if there's any other support for that. I don't know.
Well, this is also all new material, I think. Is this the first time a lot of people are seeing it?
Absolutely. People should have a chance to review it on the list and make comments.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what we could do is we have a template set up on the wiki, and you could slot the stuff into the appropriate headings based upon the discussion today, and then that'll give everybody a chance to read it and react to it over the next couple of weeks between meetings. Does that sound okay?
Sounds reasonable to me.
Yeah, this is Mikey. It sounds reasonable to me, too, but I do want to chime in behind George, since by George's definition, I'm a heavy-duty cyber squatter and never thought of myself as one before.
Because the UDRP does have protections. It says you have how to demonstrate your rights to and legitimate interest in the domain name. You could say, it's a generic name, domain, generic word, you're using it in that scope, but...
Yes, okay, so George, you're making a good point. That is also contained in the ACPA. You have an absolute defense if you believe you're making a fair use of the name.
Right, but that's why we have to put in those protections and we can't just pull out the negative part of it, your cyber squatter if. You have to put in those defenses.
You're absolutely right. It's just that we were tasked with defining what is cyber squatting. We weren't tasked with also saying what are the defenses to cyber squatting, but obviously that has to be the next step. It has to be included in our report for it to be balanced.
Well, let me ask a question. These are basically criteria. And one party, you know, a challenger might say, you meet the definition, and then someone could come back and say, well, actually, I don't. I disagree with, you know, your challenge on these following points. And then doesn't in the UDRP at least, doesn't an arbitrator then make a judgment about those arguments?
Yes.
This is Mikey. I think one of the advantages to the UDRP wording is that proscriptive, so a person can simply read the language and determine what to do, whereas if we leave this the way it stands without filling in the blanks, a person might not realize that it's perfectly all right to register a single word. And I think that's the point that George is really trying to get at.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a fair point. Maybe it would be helpful to add another section at the end of this document, which basically adopts the defenses from the UDRP and the ACPA, and then that will be more balanced when people look at this. I can do that very quickly and send it around after this call.
Why don't we just use the actual definition in the UDRP? Like, assuming this work group doesn't want to rewrite the UDRP, why not just go with the accepted standard? I think Phil has his hand up.
Do I have my hand up?
Oh. I see Phil's hand up.
Yeah, just to clarify my understanding of what... I'm trying to say how these parts work together. The first part, you were cyber squatting, yes, that's straight from the UDRP. Then we're adding everything after that is just examples of what can be bad faith. They all go to what the second part of, triple I in the UDRP. And so you have to read them together, and I'm not sure... This Roman numeral VI, it seems to create bad faith, under circumstances which George and Mikey have already spoken to, that wouldn't really be cyber squatting without additional information. If it's a generic word, which is trademarked by a lot of different parties, and you're not using it in a way which infringes any of their trademarks, you're okay. So I'm just, it seems to create a bad faith criteria where bad faith may not exist, and I think it needs work to avoid that.
I would say that it is there. Greg, if you move the screen up to the top. So it is there in little number two. You have no rights or legitimate interests in respect to the domain name. That's where you come in and say, hey, this is a generic term. I'm using it in a generic sense. Therefore, I have a legitimate interest in the name.
Yeah, but if you have a right or legitimate interest, my concern is that just reading Roman numeral VI standing alone, it seems to say that in itself can be bad faith without... I'm disturbed by saying that is per se bad faith detached from the consideration of whether you have rights or legitimate interest. So you could have a situation where you wouldn't be found guilty of cyber squatting, and yet on a standalone basis, that Roman numeral VI seems to create a presumption of bad faith where there really is no bad faith because you do have a right or a legitimate interest. I realize you wouldn't be found to be a cyber squatter. I'm still concerned about creating a standalone definition of bad faith, which is detached from other factors that really have to weigh in as to whether you are acting in bad faith.
George, here also section VI means that if you have two undeveloped dictionary words, those are not only registered in bad faith, those are actually deemed to be used in bad faith. Like it captures the and automatically, whereas, you know, you could have, you know, juice.com owned by Microsoft. It's redirected to Bing. You could have contests.com registered by Yahoo, which was pay-per-click. There's probably some registered trademark somewhere in the world for that generic domain name. You know, even though you registered it in good faith, you might not have developed it. But by this standard, if, you know, something is distinctive, i.e. it's a registered mark somewhere, in, you know, say the United States, it'll be taken to be registered and used in bad faith automatically without that two-part test. So that's why another reason why it's strike VI.
Therefore, you would not be deemed service water. So, case closed.
This is Mike.
Bottom line, I feel like your concerns are addressed here. If you have alternative language or statements that you want to make, then let's see it.
Well, so far, more people have spoken against the definition than have spoken in favor of it, so I think balances the other way. I think if more people support just the EDRP definition, we should just go with that. This is, you know, a GTLD work group, so pulling out things from the ACPA, why don't we pull out things from, you know, the Canadian version of the EDRP or, you know, Japanese or Chinese? Why pick one country when you could have registries and...
Well, it's not a bad idea, actually. There's things in the nominet rule, in the nominet procedures that I'd like incorporated in here, too, specifically the notion of recidivism. But, you know, I just had to start somewhere. I'm open, or I'm sure everyone in the subgroup is open to any other suggestions, and we should just hash it out on the list and come to a consensus, and maybe there's going to be a minority view. I don't know how many people feel one way or the other about what you two are saying on the ACPA provisions.
This is Mikey. I think that we're at a point. Originally, what we asked that group to go do was to sort of flesh things out. I think we, on the last call, what we were looking for was some examples and some clarifications. Gotten the term we used, but we had a term that we sent you all off to do. And in defense of Rodenbaugh, he took a first crack at it, sent it out to the list, didn't get much of a nibble, and that's kind of what we're looking at. So I'm agreeing with you, Mike. I think this is a great first try. We need to beat it up on the list, take a look at other versions of it that might work better, and, you know, revisit the whole document, see if it flows well, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Okay. Phil, did you have a quick comment?
Yeah, and I'm not trying to prolong this, but two other points I'd like to make about this for others to consider, and then I think probably we should all just, make further comments on the wiki and come back on this, you know, Roman numeral 6 next time. But the first is that to the extent that something is not a consensus point or there's significant controversy, since the language is that the following circumstances in particular, but without limitation, since this is not an exclusive list and anyone could argue that other things are evidence of bad faith, we probably should be tend to keep it narrow where we can reach consensus. My other concern is that on things like ACPA, points from ACPA or nominet rules or anything else, to the extent they go beyond current definition in the UDRP or common practice among UDRP arbitrators, NAF and WIPO and other places, I'm concerned that we might be getting into a policy creation area here if we get too expansive on what cyber squatting is, and that might be beyond our scope. And I raise that in the context where there is considerable debate over in regard to the IRT report recommendations, whether the URS is an implementation detail or is a major new policy, and I think we ought to try to steer clear of creating new policy in our work, because I think, you know, my position I would tend to be is that when we get into a policy area, that's a PDP issue.
Well, I mean, I guess I disagree. At this point, we are just simply trying to define what it is. So then we can analyze what are the various options that might be used to deal with it. But as Marika said earlier, I mean, we're not to the point of making policy recommendations. That's something that would happen in a furtherance of this group or in a separate group after we're done with our work.
I have a question for Mike.
I agree with Mike.
Maybe this could narrow it down. The UDRP, as Phil said, uses the words without limitation. So does VI and V add anything to the UDRP definition that doesn't already exist? If it doesn't add anything, then that means that, you know, sticking with the UDRP has the same effect. If it does add anything, then that means then obviously it's a big change.
Yeah, I guess at this point we could simply just be factual and say this is how it's defined in the UDRP. Everyone in the working group agrees with that. There are also these other elements from the ACPA. So many people, either support or whatever, however many people agree with it, and another number of people disagree with it. We could also take provisions from NominEd, do the same thing. And if anybody else has any other ideas, we would do the same thing with those ideas as well. I want to avoid arguing about this forever because it's not that critical that we come to consensus on an entire definition, including all the elements. It's just important that we document what the different factors are under the EDRP and under different countries' laws.
I think one of the questions is does this definition become a recommendation? Is that your concern, George?
Yeah. Like, what we could do is we could consider it to be a separate abuse. Maybe that's a way of handling it. Because, for example, on V, where you're providing false whois information, I think that's, you know, abusive, and, you know, we went into this debate with the whois, but, you know, I wouldn't mind if we documented it. Same for VI, if we say, you know, there are certain kinds of abuse if you know, do registrations of coined marks, you know, like Xerox or Exxon or whatever. And if you look at the Verizon lawsuits, they always list them one example per letter of the alphabet for some of these serial cyber squatters. You know, I don't mind that, you know, documenting it, but, you know, we might want to break it out so that to refine the level of support. Because if we have a, you know, if we're going to support, you know, one definition, then we have multiple levels of support within that definition. But if it becomes an either or, then it becomes much more problematic. So we could have cyber squatting, for example, slash A, UDRP, and then B, you know, NominEd, C, Japan, you know, people could pick their definitions of what they consider to be trademark abuse.
I think that we're at the point where we should move this off to the list so we can get through the other items on our agenda today.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, so the action item is Mike and his group are going to slot the material into the wiki. Sounded like there was some agreement on tweaking particular things. It'll be up on the wiki where the entire group can take a look at it. Everyone should take a look and provide comments back on the list before our next meeting. Okay. And Phil, I see your hand's gone, Phil. Okay.
No. One final thought. I understand what Mike's trying to get at here, but I think my suggestion would be, and I just want to float this for people to think about as we depart this issue, is that rather than trying to incorporate something from U.S., something fairly new from U.S. trademark law or something from Nominet, we have just six might be your registration of acquisition of domain names either violates relevant national law or the registry rules for the name you've registered, which would kind of incorporate, would say, you know, if you're subject to ACPA, if you're in the U.S. and you've done something intentionally in violation of that law, that could be evidence of bad faith. If you've done something in violation of Nominet rules, that could be evidence of bad faith. But so it kind of references the differences around the world without trying to incorporate different pieces that are accepted in one place and not accepted somewhere else. So just a thought there on how we might approach this.
My only concern, George here, my only concern is that when you start saying with reference to national laws, those national laws are interpreted by courts, whereas if these abuse policies are ultimately going to be interpreted by registrars and registries, we don't want to be setting up the registries and registrars as final courts. That, you know, they should be ones to implement decisions made by real courts, not by themselves. And I'm sure probably Phil shares my concern with that.
That's fine. That's something that we would get to later, though. We don't need to get there right now at the definitional stage.
Okay. All right. Well, we have action items. Let's move on. It's 10 after the hour. We have 20 more minutes left in our meeting. Next item is an update from the Uniformity and Contracts Group, which is Barry, Mikey, Mike Rodenbaugh, et cetera.
Barry, you want to do this one? Or are you driving?
I'm kind of multitasking, but I'll give it a quick stab. Basically, last Monday, Mikey and myself met to just informally kind of discuss the topic about uniformity. We started off the discussion keying off from Marika's email that summarized the language that was listed in our charter, as well as some findings from the issues report. Basically, the question that was on the table is, you know, is further research needed as it relates to uniformity? I think we all on the call understand that there is zero uniformity out there, or if not zero, pretty close to zero, in terms of uniformity of abuse languages and contracts, et cetera. The question on the table is, you know, about really what scope and overall effort of research that needs to be expended to further define that answer, which is the lack of uniformity. So basically, we started off talking about what we have to date. Again, there was some research conducted by ICANN staff in the issues report. That does a very good job of giving us the answer, you know, there is no uniformity out there. The second component is on the side, I've started collecting some research data, basically of a number of the registrar-registrant agreements, and I was looking to try to quantitatively tag the various registrars out there as to what abuse provisions they have in their contracts, et cetera. Right now I have about 93 registrars across 46 countries, and basically those countries that had more than 10 registrars, I took the top 10 per webhosting.info, the top 10 of the number of registrars, registered domains. So really the question becomes is, if we do find value in trying to quantitatively put some numbers around the lack of uniformity, then we should move forward with that. In terms of scope, or continued scope in this research, is how much further do we want to go down the rabbit hole? I think we've got an understanding about registry GTLD contracts and what abuse languages or provisions they may have in there. Do we also want to include contracts, if we can even get to them, from registry to registrar about abuse provisions, et cetera? And let's see, what else am I missing here? Kind of going off a status email I sent. Oh, the third area, which was listed in the charter, is basically to understand what activities are going on to date at the registry registrar level and how they handle abuse cases, whether they have any language listed in their contracts or not. How does a particular registrar handle a cyber squatting type issue or any of the other types of abuses that we've identified? The takeaway out of this section was that perhaps in conjunction with some of the research that we would perform, you know, we've identified 20 or so or 26 or so abuse types, whether it's pre-registration, registration, or use. We take those and, again, quantitatively attach that with the research, but then out of that build some sort of questionnaire/survey that we could either engage the registry, registrar constituencies to help us complete the survey, but basically asking them, you know, what things are you guys doing, whether you have, you know, abuse policies in place or not, so that we get a better understanding of what's going on out there. There's definitely a lot more research and direction that we need to define there before we march forward. And then basically the last topic was, you know, how frequently should the sub-team meet? If we do move forward with the research, there probably is a sizable amount of effort, so how do we dole up the work effort there? And basically then how do we package this up and report back to the working group? So that's kind of a high-level summary. Again, it was just Mikey and myself. Sometime later this week or early next week, I'd like to get the team together again just so that we can kind of finalize some direction and get some consensus on where we should be going. Thank you.
This is Mikey. Just to add one thing. One of the things we talked about, and James Bladel, I'm sort of talking to you on this one, but it's really the registry to registrar contracts, of course, are not, for the most part, public. But what I was curious about was whether the abuse portions of those contracts could somehow be extracted and shared with the working group. Do you think that's possible? I know that getting the whole contract.
Hey, Mikey, this is Greg. I think that all of the registry registrar contracts or the GTLDs.
Yeah, the RRA should be
are public.
Available, isn't it?
Oh, are they?
Yeah, they are public.
Usually. Okay, never mind.
What they're usually listed as an appendix in the ICANN contracts that they post on the ICANN website. So you'll find a section under the document section of the ICANN website, and in there are all of the registry ICANN contracts.
The registry.
Yeah, and then ICANN has put the ICANN actually dictates the, in a lot of them at least, the wording of the registry registrar contract. So the whole thing's there.
Ah, okay.
So now, we'd have to check to see if that's true in every case, especially with STLDs.
Okay. I was always under the impression that registry registrar contracts were negotiated.
No. Mm-hmm. They have to be uniform.
Not usually.
Okay. Never mind.
But like I said, you guys would want to go into the ICANN site there, and I don't know if all the STLDs are... There may be cases where there's some language that ICANN requires, but that may not be the entire contract that the registry has with the registrar. So that'd be something to check on.
Yeah. Well,
actually, you're right. Some of the sponsored ones don't have it. I'm looking at .jobs, and it doesn't have it.
Yeah,
that was my impression as well. The registrar contracts aren't as available, and Barry, I think, was looking for some of those and also having a little trouble. So we could do some help either finding them, or if they indeed aren't public, recruiting some registry/registrar support for the survey where they would extract the abuse provision, not revealing secret stuff.
So George has just sent around a link to .org, and I know for sure it also exists for .asia, so that's a start anyway.
Margie, did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up. My understanding is they are all public and they're all standard. I'll confirm that, but that's my understanding. And what I can do is I can send a link, an email with links to the various contracts. Or if you want additional analysis, I've already looked at those for some of the presentations that I put together and could extract the abuse provisions from them and put them in a little summary if that's useful to the group.
Oh, that's hugely useful.
Okay. Okay, well, make that an action item for me, and I'll take care of it.
Terrific. Thanks a million.
Okay.
Now, George here, I was just going to add, I posted in the comments that maybe we can get some of the non-English ones translated, possibly by staff or Google Translate, because a lot of the more abusive registrants intentionally seek out registrars that are located in non-English speaking countries. So there might be a disproportionate amount of abuse coming from those registrars with non-English registration agreements.
This is Barry. Thank you, George. In terms of what I had collected in terms of the registrar contracts that I had seen now, I had only pulled the English ones because I just couldn't do anything with non-English contracts.
All right. Maybe we can get some staff support or just translate it with Google Translate or something for free.
Can I also comment? I believe if it's translated, it's the same language. They translate off the English version. But, again, I'll confirm that.
Well, that's the RRAs, but I think Barry's talking about the registrar-registrant agreements.
Right, where they don't have a non-English. Like, let's say you have a Chinese registrar that only has an agreement in Chinese.
Oh, okay. You're correct. In that situation, it would be specific to that registrar. If you have, I guess we do have some translation capability that I could look into whether we want to ask for some language to be translated, but it would be an entire contract because we won't know which section applies to registration abuse, so it might take some time.
Or maybe we could do a Google Translate as a first pass, and then if we find that there is an abuse section, maybe they could just translate that one section to be able to help the work group have a good definition as opposed to a machine-generated translation for that one section.
Yeah, that might work.
Sounds like a good approach.
So I do have a question for the entire working group in relation to this topic. Is there value in trying to quantitatively tag the registrar community out there in the registrant contracts about abuse language? And my thought track about this was starting with GoDaddy as an example and reviewing all of their contracts for abuse language and literally dumping this into a spreadsheet that says, okay, do they have any provisions for cyber squatting? Do they have any provisions for anti-phishing or spamming and et cetera? And putting a check mark, yes, they do, one for yes, zero for no, and doing that for all of the 96-plus agreements that we've collected to this point, and then trying to graph it out and getting some visual interpretation to that answer of lack of uniformity. Would we agree that there's value in seeing that? Because I think there is quite a deal amount of effort there. Or is this something that we already know the answer to? Let's just kind of move on.
This is Marika. If I can just comment, because I think we did some of that work in the issues report where we tried to sample some of those agreements, and I think what we concluded there as well that it might be important as well to look at how effective those provisions actually are and how they are being implemented, because in the end, you know, we might have a full list of who has provisions and for what issues, but if we cannot make an assessment of whether those are deemed effective in addressing abuse and how these are actually being used, if at all, in addressing abuse, I'm not sure how valuable, you know, the complete overview will be.
Absolutely, and so the sister part to that effort is then the questionnaire/survey so that we can get a true understanding of what actions the community or registrars and registries are really taking up there and then trying to marry them together.
Yeah, this is Mikey. Remember that the focus of what we were looking at was not effectiveness but uniformity. And I think the question that Barry's got on the table is a really important one. If we know that there is no uniformity sufficiently well, maybe the quantitative analysis isn't worth the effort. My intuition on the call when Barry and I were on the phone was that this would be very interesting.
I think we did already conclude from the issues report that there is no uniformity. But the other question is, like, you know, would there be a need for uniformity? Would that help the community? Or I think some argued as well that, you know, it might help distinguish approaches or, you know, how do you define whether one is better over the other? So I think there are a number of questions that I think that the issues report did establish that there is no uniformity, but I think, you know, some of the questions a group will need to ask is, like, you know, first of all, is there a need for uniformity? And if so, what would that uniformity look like, and what are the elements, and how is it actually implemented in the facts?
Yeah, I think that's well put.
Yeah, and I think that's a good course correction for us. If that's indeed the sense of the group, then what we will tend to do is focus more on those kinds of questions in our subsequent call.
Yeah. So those would be questions like, assuming there's no uniformity, which seems to be the case, then what does that mean?
Right. And is there value? You know, what are the pros and cons of establishing uniformity, and what are the mechanisms for doing that? One of the concerns that I have is that we don't drive everybody to a lowest common denominator, force them there.
Exactly, Mike.
You know, if there's a mechanism where we can put in a minimum standard and allow plenty of flexibility and creativity to go beyond those standards, that's probably an approach that we'd prefer, but we haven't really gotten to that discussion in the subgroup.
And certainly one of my desires, if we did march down the road of any of the other quantitative research, is, you know, trying to develop a baseline and or a best of breed. You know, who is the registrar out there, or multiple registrars that have all of the abuse language and provisions in their contracts that fully execute against those provisions to either prevent and or mitigate abuses? You know, what does that best of breed look like? And I'm not sure we all have our hunches, but, you know, I don't know that anything has been formally produced in that regard.
I guess, this is Mikey again, I guess one of the questions to the group is, we could probably use either a registrar or a registry rep in this subgroup just so that we don't get hung up accidentally asking for something that's impossible. Does anybody want to join us?
Mikey, this is James. We can talk offline. I can join.
That'd be great.
Okay, great. So that's about all we have for now, Greg.
Yeah, there are people from registries like Nacho's out with a bum leg this week. We can see if they are interested in helping. Now, we should also go back to the charter question, which is really about the substance of the differences. the question in the charter is, if registration abuses are occurring that might be better curtailed or better addressed if consistent policies were established. And we're supposed to determine if and how abuse is dealt with in those registries and registrars that do not have policies, and identify how registration abuse provisions are implemented in practice or deemed effective in addressing registration abuse. I think that's a good encapsulation of the substantive issues that Mikey and others have pointed to, Marika have pointed to.
Now, this is Mikey. In order to really do justice to that, I am still quite taken with Barry's research approach, because I think we've proven that there is no uniformity, but I don't think we know as much as we could about the dimensions of that uniformity, I guess. And so I am still pretty keen on Barry's research approach and wouldn't necessarily think that it's inconsistent with our other parts of the charter. But I'd like to get a sense from people, because as Barry's pointed out, and I will agree, it's a bunch of work.
Well, would it be an option, maybe as a first start, to indeed survey the registrar and registry community? We can maybe there work with the different representatives and create a relatively straightforward survey using SurveyMonkey and try to see if we get some feedback in that way that might help us get started.
There's one for the registrar members and maybe the constituencies. Greg, James, what do you think? Is that a better approach?
I don't know, actually.
And one of the advantages to Barry's approach is that you've got a boatload of data points already. It's no work for our registrars or registries to do as we would do it. It's basically just sampling contracts and writing them down.
But how would you assess, like, what they do in practice? I mean, the idea for me for the survey would be to ask some more questions, like, do you deem this effective in addressing some of these, to capture it already broader and not only look at the provisions, which, some of the data is already captured as well in the issues report.
This is only talking about what's in their contract. It's not talking about what they do.
I still don't understand what, I think it's a nice to have probably an overview of all the contracts, but what do you feel is missing from the sample or that was already carried out as part of the issues report, which basically says, well, there's, many have provisions, but there's no uniformity. What additional information do you think you'll find by capturing them all?
This gets back to Barry's point about taking a look at sort of the best practices. If it turns out that lots and lots and lots of registrars and registries have a given kind of abuse provision, that might be a candidate for the best practices.
But you still don't know whether that one is effective. It might just be that they've copied it from, their competitor or someone they've been working with. So that's a bit, the question I'm asking. It's nice to have the overview, but it doesn't give you any information on how effective they actually are in practice, because it might just be indeed that they've looked at other examples of contracts, like, what often happens, they just take provisions and stick them into their contract. So,
Marika, and so what we would look at possibly doing is, let's say out of the research, we've identified 15 different registrars that do have these provisions in their contracts, and then we actually maybe even somehow confronts, not the right word, but approach them and develop some sort of dialogue, how are you guys actually handling this? And then somehow trying to measure their effectiveness of having those in there. But, right now we can only speculate what kind of registrars might have, you know, be doing a good job. We just simply don't know. So there's definitely two parts to that. Is one is let's see what's out there from a contract perspective. Second part is let's approach these guys and or these organizations and understand exactly what they are doing. To Mary, to your point.
Okay, this is Greg. We're at a couple of minutes past the end of the meeting, so we should wrap up. I see James's hand was up, and then we'll need to wrap.
Yeah, Greg, and I can take this offline just real quickly. I think that the issues report fairly conclusively establishes that there's no uniformity in the contracts, the registration agreements. And then I think that it's an open question of whether uniformity is something that we desire or whether it is something that would take away from those registrars who are exercising discretion and haven't made the investments in preventing abuse. So I think that, you know, I'll just leave it at that. But this is, it's, while it's tempting to say let's go get a lot more data and research on this, I think that we have to be very careful about what that possibly implies we would then want to use that for. So I think that we should probably take this offline into that separate group, Mikey, and I would welcome being included in that.
Okay. This is Greg. My suggestion is that the group huddle and then come back with the recommendation for outreach. What do you want to ask and to whom?
Yeah, that sounds like a great approach. And sorry, folks, that we didn't have some of those answers for you today, but clearly we need to work on that, and we will have them for you next time.
Much appreciated. It's an important but complicated probably undertaking, so good to talk about it. So, James, you want to be added into that effort or that subgroup?
Yes, please.
Okay. Did anyone else want to be? Okay. All right. So we'll add James into that subgroup. Okay. We're a little past our meeting point, so thanks for bearing with. Let's have the minutes note that Bo Brendler did join us late. And we've got a few takeaways for next week. I'll put those in the meeting minutes. Rod Rasmussen says he needs to do some work on his wiki for domain names used for malware. He had to step away a few minutes ago, but he'll work on that for next time. And I want to respect your time, so if unless anyone else has any questions or comments, I want to bring us to a conclusion for this time. Anything else? Okay, good. And next week, one of the things we'll need to talk about is kind of overall scheduling and how we're progressing towards some dates that we do need to discuss some deadlines and so forth. Council does require occasional updates from us as to progress and ETAs. So we'll put that on the agenda for next time. Okay. If nothing else, thanks everyone for your time. That was a very good discussion. I'm glad we're getting into, you know, into the meat of these topics. Please do continue to discuss on the list over the next 2 weeks. Please start putting material into the wikis because that will eventually produce material for our initial report. And we will meet again 2 weeks from today. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Take care.
Thanks,